She wants, but she's no longer wanting. Life's changing, friends fade away. Such a pretty face with that long blonde hair, deep blue eyes with an 80s ugly stare. Darling, don't let yourself down.
Goodbye Robin Williams edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Ebola redox, send doctors, not vaccines, religious accommodation at our airports, women need not apply, safety and the possible crime of driving while brown, and look at the funny side of Robin Williams, reflections and laughs at the man who touched our lives. Let's begin episode 263.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome, tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week, wine is an Ebola redux. Yes, just when you thought we were over the highly lethal blood virus and you'd covered every bloody thing about it, the popular press finds yet another way to infect your mind with crap. Last week, we discussed a controversy that arose about how when only black people were getting ill, there was no treatment. But once a couple of white folk got sick, suddenly there was a miracle cure. Well, this week, it seems the press has taken the possibility of a vaccine and ran with it. They were not talking about if there was a cure, but how fast we could get it to the poor people of Africa, and how much was available, and can we increase production? Could this be the end of the Ebola outbreak? Well, I hate to be a stick in the mud, but there is no cure. There's no effective treatment for humans at all. Not a bupkis. What there are experimental drugs that have shown some potential promise in animal trials. No trials in humans have ever been done, well, at least until last week, and those hardly qualify as proper trials. And for the record, what is being tried is called a serum. Not really a vaccine or the like. A serum is all the parts of the blood that are not actually what we think of as blood. So blood cells, red and white, are removed, and so are the clotting factors. What you have left, among other things, and most importantly for our discussion, are antibodies. In this context, they harvest the antibodies from an infected but recovering individual, then shoot those into a sick patient. The idea is to provide what the Army would call a rapid response troops in order to shore up the front lines until the body's own immune system can produce antibodies of sufficient quality on its own. Now, I'm unsure where the source of the antibodies actually come from. We must remember, these are very experimental lab-based projects. Also note, I shall commit the sin of conflating serum, vaccine, and drug as sort of the same concept. I have faith in my loyal listeners that they have the intelligence to sort out what I actually mean. Okay, so who cares about all that? As I said, they were only lab-based projects that had only done some animal testing. So far, their efficacy in humans, well, there's no evidence of that at all. But you might say, Don, didn't it cure those Americans? The honest answer is who knows. It seems the lethality of this Ebola outbreak is about 75%. There were three people who have so far been given the experimental drugs. Of those, one has recovered, one is still sick, and the other has died. So there's no way of knowing if the one who's recovered wouldn't have recovered irrespective of the treatment. Now, what fueled this talk about the vaccines is the World Health Organization, or the WHO. And please, no Abbott and Costello jokes. The WHO announced that it will allow the use of experimental drugs in this current epidemic. It seems the popular press, and sadly much of the alternative press, has taken this as an endorsement of the efficacy of these treatments, which it's not. Sadly, there is likely little to no scientific or medical value in providing these drugs. It seems unlikely that there will be a miracle cure in any of them. So unless everyone who gets the treatment either survives or dies, we have no way of separating noise from science. Remember, these are experimental drugs never tested on humans, so they could do as much harm as good. And of course, it would be almost impossible to track any ill effects thanks to Ebola's rather messy MO. Because of the condition that these drugs are being used, even if they were effective in fighting Ebola, complications due to unsanitary health conditions, other factors like malnutrition, delays in application of the drugs, well, there's no way to separate positive from negative effects, if there are any effects at all. There's also the issue of getting viable serum to the patient. The drug used on the Yank needs to be kept cold at all times. Remember, these are war-torn, poverty-stricken nations. The possibility that the drugs might get warm and thus ruined is extremely high. So even if you did get a needle, you may be getting a dud anyway. Now you might ask, if they have no medical use, why did the WHO authorize their use? Well, there are two psychological reasons. The first can be found in the 75% lethality number. People know there are drugs out there. Not likely informed enough to know that they're useless, but even if they did know, Ebola is such a horrific death that any hope, however remote, is worth a try, at least from the standpoint of the patient. It's the same tendency that practitioners of voodoo and charlatans use to prey upon people who are suffering from cancer or the like and bilk them out of their last dollar by hawking some miracle cure that's nothing more than snake oil. So why give a useless drug to an infected and those at risk? One, snake oil does have one positive power, and that's the placebo effect. So essentially the WHO is prescribing West Africa one big placebo. Two, the drug companies probably like the press, which will lead to more investment and likely tax write-offs. And three, the West likes it because it makes it look like we care, that we're doing something, in spite of the facts on the ground. And that leads to the second psychological effect. The fact that these drugs only appeared when white people got sick. Irrespective of their effectiveness, to deny their use would make it look like blacks aren't worthy of these drugs. So in order to remove the sense of guilt that the West may have for not making these drugs available, there needed to be a grand gesture, and thus the WHO's announcement. Of course, never getting bored about talking about ourselves, the Western press quickly moved to the quote, important issue of ethics. This issue also seems to have two main threads. One, was it ethical to treat the poor people in Africa as guinea pigs? As I have already said, there's no medical use in vaccinating these people. And the only real scientific use is to find catastrophic failures or side effects. Some people are casting this as a way for these companies to do human trials without proper consent or testing that would be mandatory before Western nations would allow these drugs to be tried. Again, because there's no real scientific value, I will for once not condemn the corporations here. But there is a subtext in all this thought with regards to consent. If one reads between the lines, you find that, based on the reporting, people in Africa are too poor, illiterate, and, well, too stupid, their sentiment, not mine, for anyone there to provide proper consent. To be sure, there is little education, the region has suffered several wars, and there are a lot of people who believe in magic. We talked on the show before about witch hunting and people burned at the stake. That said, most Americans believe in ghosts, and even in Canada, we have an exorcism or two. So casting stones in glass houses, not a smart thing. Yes, I'm looking at you, Tea Party. Put the rock down. Anyway, what this does show is what might qualify as racism, or at least stereotyping. There is an implied sentiment that in these countries, no one is capable of giving informed consent. An interesting, though sad thing, is that prior to the Americans getting the drug, Sheikh Hamar Khan, a prominent Sierra Leone doctor who was a major actor on the front line in trying to control the disease, was himself infected. There was much debate amongst his doctors whether to give him the serum or not. They decided that the risk of an untested drug was too great, although he did eventually die a few days later from Ebola. But there you have it. The people who would most likely receive the drugs would be the doctors and nurses manning the front line, those most at risk and most needed to fight the epidemic. These people are well-educated professionals, and to imply that just because it's Africa, that it would be impossible to find anyone smart enough, well, that's just sad. What is saddest of all is while the drugs have dominated media coverage, the real need, the real story, the thing we could do to help is being ignored. I listened to a couple of interviews by individuals who are working with people on the front line, and they all say the same thing. Shut up about the drugs. What we need is help, people, supplies. One of the major reasons this outbreak is so much worse than previous ones is location. In the past, Ebola had the decency to only appear in isolated, sparsely populated areas where containment and quarantine were relatively easy. This outbreak is in the middle of a highly mobile, densely populated urban environment. This is why the disease has spread across three, maybe four borders. So far, the only major actor has been Doctors Without Borders, and they have said that they've exhausted their resources. According to the Council of Foreign Relations, there are about 50 doctors left in Liberia, a nation of 4 million, to fight this epidemic. And to make things even better, in Nigeria, the likely next front in the war of Ebola, the health minister just fired 16,000 doctors who went on strike. These numbers not only make treatment difficult, but one of the important activities is to ensure containment, is to find out who contacted who. You need to round up everyone and isolate them, or the disease will continue to spread. There are two stories that help exemplify the need and the problem with containment. The first case is in Nigeria with Patrick Sawyer, a Liberian who knowingly left his homeland and traveled to Lagos because he had no faith in his own country's health system and thought he would get better treatment in Nigeria. He knew he was sick. He was desperate. He got onto a plane, taking care, thankfully, not to contact anyone on the plane, and handed himself over to authorities in Lagos, wanting to be taken to one of their hospitals for treatment. Then it turns out one of the nurses treating Patrick, for fear of her life, escaped quarantine and returned to her home village, where she may have contaminated over 100 people. Fortunately, none seemed to be infected. Chalk went up to luck. Another major issue just occurred was the sacking of an Ebola treatment center. Members of a slum in Monrovia were not convinced that Ebola was real and saw it as a way for the government to remove their shantytown. Others thought it was a plot by the government to infect the poor to get rid of them. Regardless of why, a mob not only forced the patients to run for their life, but they also stole everything in sight, including soil bedding, mattresses, contaminated medical equipment, and the like. Experts are now expecting a major outbreak in the slum in the upcoming weeks, in an area where hygiene is already non-existent. Couple that with an infrastructure where services like running water is hard to come by, even in a hospital. Say you get all the infected into hospitals. Those taking care of them are likely to come in contact and spread disease for no other reason than lack of proper medical supplies, like said water, or gloves, or bedding, or, well, you get the point. So if the West, the world, really wanted to help, they would stop wasting breath on non-existent miracle vaccines. They would send in medical personnel and supplies to make a real difference. I find it funny, in a not really funny way, that Obama, reluctantly but consistently, was able to find the time to bomb people in Iraq for humanitarian reasons, but seems incapable of sending in a platoon of medics to help fight the Ebola epidemic. If you'd like to make a difference, please go to msf.ca, that's the Doctors Without Borders website, and give. Contact your local MP and say, hey, it's great we're giving drugs that don't work, that we have sent three shipments of aid to the Ukraine, spent millions of aid to Iraq, but what about sending some of those peacekeepers we used to be proud about to help contain the outbreak? Provide clean water, doctors, field hospitals that can actually quarantine people. I am pleased that the press have not yet bored of the Ebola epidemic like it has with Gaza, Libya, and oh yes, anyone remember Syria? That's still going on. However imperfect, at least we are aware and can do something. So get off your arse now and do something. I'm going to close this segment with part of a Democracy Now! Interview with Laura Grett. She's Senior Fellow for Global Health at the Council of Foreign Relations. Take note of the exasperation in her voice.
Ebola is an RNA virus that infects your endothelial cells, which are the linings of blood cells and vessels, capillaries, puncturing microscopic leaks in them, which grow with time, and you begin to lose all the fluids from your circulatory system into your body as a whole, out of your eyes, out of your nose, out of your mouth, every orifice of the body. Those fluids are filled with virus, and anyone who touches those fluids and then, you know, touches their eye or rubs their nose will become infected. And some of the numbers being tossed around, I heard you say 90% mortality rate. These are gross exaggerations, but it is a truly horrible disease. In only one outbreak did the death toll reach 90%. That was 1976. I was in the 1995 outbreak, which until now was the largest. The current one is more than three times larger. And the death toll was closer to 70%. But it's still, I mean, my goodness. You know, when you see an average flu in circulation and you think it's a bad flu, you're under 1% mortality rate, to put that in comparison.
And the response, the worldwide response to this outbreak, how do you assess how that has gone so far?
Outrageous. Outrageous. I've been stunned and flabbergasted since March, when this was first reported from Guinea. And I concur completely with the statements made by Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders. They've consistently said, you know, we're the only ones out here. Help. Hello, everybody. There's an Ebola epidemic going on. Hello, it's spreading across a border. Oh, it spread another border. What are you all waiting for? I have a piece right now in Foreign Policy that begins, world, you just don't get it. The scale of what we need to be doing versus what we are doing is, you know, log scale differential. All the healthcare workers are burned out. Let's put this in perspective. Excuse me. There's no water here. Put this in perspective. Before we had an epidemic, these three countries had three of the worst healthcare systems on the planet and the poorest people on the planet. And not one of those governments was spending more than $100 per capita annually on all forms of health, which in this country keeps a household stocked in aspirin and ibuprofen. And Liberia had about 200 physicians to service 4 million people. About half of those physicians were non-Liberians, foreigners. Ebola struck, a lot of those foreigners left town. They're down now to 50 physicians to deal with everything. Now, as the Ebola crisis gets worse, cardiac patients are going untreated. Women are giving delivery without assistance. You've got automobile accidents with people's legs cut off and nobody will accept them into an ER. It's so much bigger than people realize and that people accept. What we need is hundreds of healthcare workers in these countries immediately. Hundreds. And we're getting dribs and drabs. And we don't need, I know you have a lot of very motivated viewers and listeners, we don't need the do-gooder who's never been out in a crisis before. It's very nice of you to volunteer, but you're not necessary. We need people who have history of working under great trauma, who know how to work in the tropical heat, who know how to maintain personal infection control and are prepared to deal with some psychologically devastating things.
And the implication of the disease spreading into Nigeria?
Unbelievably important. Now, let's be cautious. At this moment, we have no evidence of secondary transmission. So everybody that's been proven to have Ebola in Nigeria got it directly from this one fellow, Patrick Sawyer, a Liberian businessman who flew for a meeting to Lagos and contaminated people who were part of his entourage and the medical providers who cared for him.
A Liberian-American, right?
A Liberian-American. However, one of the nurses under quarantine, a suspect but not proven case, fled quarantine a couple of days ago, went to the city of Enugu, and now more than 120 people of her contacts are under observation. In addition, at least two of the individuals, one his escort and the other a physician, have died of Ebola in Lagos. The concern, of course, is if it gets beyond that circle, because you cannot ask for a more chaotic city than Lagos, Nigeria. Anybody that's there, has ever been there, knows there's no such thing as a street map for most of the city. Contact tracing, finding, you know, who might have infected who, oh my goodness. And on top of it all, they have a national doctor's strike, they have a civil war, and they have a national election, and oh yes, Boko Haram.
We'll be back after this break.
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreeThinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreeThinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
And we're back. I came across a story a few days back that I'm surprised has not become a big or at least a minor issue. Apparently, last month, several inspectors of the Canadian Border Security Agency, CBSA, working at Terminal 3 at Pearson International Airport, were told they were being reassigned to a different terminal. Why, you may ask? Well, it seems that a group of SEDUs, forgive my pronunciation, were passing through, and they demanded that certain people should not be present as they would corrupt or pollute the area and these holy people. Now, I'm going to stop there and ask you, is there any group of people where you would think that such a request, at least here in Canada, would be tolerated, seem appropriate? If SEDUs were a bunch of KKK and they didn't want any black people to touch them or their goods, we'd say, what the? If they were members of the neo-Nazi group and they wanted to ensure no Jews, quote, polluted their things, we would obviously say no. We're not going to respect a request. It's offensive. No pun intended. Well, as it turns out, the offending group was women. When female staff at Terminal 3 were told they needed to move, they were understandably upset. Beyond the personal insult, the impression it can leave on fellow employees, especially in a male-dominated profession, well, there's also professional ramifications. And yet, the CBSA acquiesced to the request of the SEDUs. Just an FYI, SEDUs are Hindu holy men who are attempting to obtain the highest level of being. It is seen as the completion of the fourth and final stage of life. How this is attained? Well, there's no specific doctrine or practice. There are several sects and each profess to know the true way, and yes, some SEDUs are women. However, this particular sect seems to see women as somehow corrupting or a source of pollution. Perhaps an appropriate way to think about this is to see them as some kind of evangelical fundamentalist that you'd see in the southern United States, or sadly perhaps the Okanagan or Southern Fraser Valley, Canada's own Bible Belt. So beyond a belief in God, the rest they just make up, ergo no consistent practice. Some SEDUs wear no clothing, some live a life of poverty, others live communal lives of meditation. Anyway, the women involved are worried that if they complain, they might lose their job. Their union stated that they may file a complaint to the Human Rights Commission. Why were the first examples I give, the KKK and the neo-Nazis, such an evident no, we should not concede to their demand, and yet they did so for the SEDUs? Well, a larger issue arises. How tolerant should we be of intolerance? So why are we not tolerant of the KKK, the neo-Nazis? Well, their accommodation, if I may use such a benign word, well, they are political, social, culturally based. And we as a society have said that those beliefs are not sufficient to trump another's rights, the right of equality. Why did the CBSA treat the Saito's request differently? Why did they give in? Well, obviously, religion. A major issue in the last provincial election in Quebec was the idea of religious accommodation. Sadly, the PQ were not standing up so much for a secular government, but more of a racist one, where if your religious symbolism was brown, it was forbidden. Think Muslim hijab, Sikh kirpan. But if it were white, think the cross of the National Assembly, well, that was cultural and okay, obviously. That said, their point was valid. We should be intolerant of intolerance, not only in the realm of social beliefs, but religious ones. We should give them no more or less weight than one's belief in equality or environmentalism or racism. In the case of the KKK, they have freedom of thought, of belief. So if they wish to be racist and exercise their right of expression, no problem, as long, of course, we avoid that whole hate speech thing. However, they do not have a right not to be offended. Rights in Canada, as opposed to the US, are much more malleable, less absolute. One of the reasons why the Yanks live by the credo, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, well, we opted for peace, order, and good governance. Yay, Victorian values. Returning to the Saidu and the women of the SPCA, we have a right of equality on the one hand, and a right not to be offended on the other. It seems that the SPCA placed offense above equality. This strikes me as not only wrong, but obscene. There comes a point where we must be intolerant of intolerance. I and many Canadians find it offensive that CEOs make in a day what their employees make in a year. Yet my right not to be offended seems to take second place to their right to greed. I am offended that a televangelist can pay no taxes because God? Well, Harper cuts welfare for low-income families ostensibly because there's not enough money raised by taxes to pay for it. Now, there is hate speech, so some forms of offense are valid. But the problem arises, when should we allow offense to trump others' rights? Well, in this instance, we could use the Hitler test. If you substitute the subject with Hitler or Nazi and the object with Jew, well, if it sounds okay, then we're likely on sound ground. If it reminds us of the war, probably time to say no. So let's test our theory. Harper hates pandas. Hitler hates Jews. Not a nice thing, but no harm is really done, so no problem. Harper will never read a socialist newspaper. Hitler will never read a Jewish newspaper. Still okay. The Sandus will not eat meals made with raw meat. The Nazis will not eat meals made with kosher meat. Still not nice, but okay. Okay, now that seems to work. Now for the big one. The Sadhus want all women removed because they are a source of corruption. Well, let's make our changes and we get the Nazis want all Jews removed because they're a source of corruption. Ding, 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 ding. Okay, I think it's obvious the CBSA did wrong. But I think also the Sadhus betrayed themselves. These guys, and I can't really bring myself to call them gentlemen, so these guys are sacrificing in order to become more pure, more holy. Sacrificing to complete one's life. Many Hindus never attempt this final phase in life because it's too hard to attain. And therein lies the rub. If they demand people change, reorder the world so that they don't actually have to sacrifice anything, is it really a sacrifice? If they really want it to be pure and not corrupted, take that as you may, well, one thing they might have to sacrifice is taking a plane trip to Toronto. It's like a person who takes a vow of poverty and then demands that the government or whoever provides them with free meal, housing. While we're at it, why not free cars, computers, 70-inch TVs? You may own nothing, but conversely, you've given up nothing. There is no sacrifice, and thus the effort rings hollow at best, hypocritical at worst. I hope the union files a complaint, that in the future, employees are not intimidated by management and such requests be refused in the future. That we as a nation, as a people, move on and treat religion like any other belief system. Give the freedom they all deserve, but no more than that. So on that note, we're going to take another break. And come back and remember Robin Williams, the funny man, the great man, a man who touched us all, after this break.
Today in the news.
And today in the news.
Today in the news.
Tired of the same few voices giving you the same point of view on the news? You're not alone. The Campaign for Democratic Media is a nonpartisan, nonprofit group fighting to ensure that our public airwaves represent more than just one voice. Canadians deserve diverse, accountable, and quality Canadian media. Visit democraticmedia.ca to learn how you can stand up for media issues.
And we're back. As most of our listeners know, Robin Williams succumbed to depression last week and passed away. We're planning on doing a show in the near future on mental illness and the pains and problems of depression, anxiety, and similar afflictions. It may strike some of you as odd the way I chose to state how he passed away. The common narrative is to say that he committed suicide and was suffering from depression, as though those were somehow separate. It'd be like saying he committed suicide and had a red Ferrari. Suicide was the part of his mental illness. It was a symptom, sadly far too often a fatal symptom. In the same way someone suffering from hepatitis may die from liver failure, so do some people who have depression die from suicide. But I don't want to spend too much time on that today. Robin Williams was a man of contradictions, and we will cover the dark side of his life in the future. Today, we're going to celebrate the lighter side, the funny side, the part that will always be a part of my life, and why is passing such a tragedy. I first remember being exposed to Robin as Mork from Mork, the short-lived but landmark comedy show of the early 80s. Here's a clip from his show.
Susan Taylor invited me by her shop. She's going to have a makeup demonstration, and she wants me to be the model.
Oh, like the ones in Playboy.
Hi, my name is Candy. My hobbies are body surfing and neutron physics, and I hope to one day know the entire Los Angeles Rams.
But my favorite is this lonesome ranger. I would give anything to meet Mr. Ranger. Ah.
I think the part of his magic that was the biggest impact on my life, the part of his passion that helped lighten my life in times of darkness, was his stand-up. Robin was the improvisational stand-up comedian. He was not only a genius at it during his stand-up routines, but if you ever, and I mean ever, see him in any context outside of a scripted show or movie, and often there as well, he was always being the funny man, always doing his iconic manic improv. Again, this may reflect inner demons, but I shall, at least for this show, choose to see it as part of his personality he just couldn't contain, that he was so full of joy at times that he had to make everyone around him laugh. Laughter is a gift. And Robin was not only gifted, but giving. Many a story has come to life about how he made private and personal gestures to those people who were suffering personal defeats or were down. That he was a tireless participant in the USO. Now, most people now know him for his movie roles, Mrs. Doubtfire or Aladdin. Some don't see him as a comedian, but a great dramatic actor like The Fisher King or the Dead Poets Society. As I've already said, the world's lost one of the greatest among us. But this is a celebration of his life and legacy. As I said to me, his most impactful work was his stand-up. So we're going to close the show by playing what I think is his best clips, or at least the best I can remember. A man of his caliber has done far more than my feeble memory can do justice. But here's my tribute to the funniest of funny men. Goodbye, Robin. You will be missed.
Want a linguistic adventure? Go drinking with a Scotsman, because you can't fucking understand them before. You land in Scotland and they're going, "Tittle kip any, feel I?" Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, right, you think, eh?
That thing looks like bundle bullets, that cigarette paper, than you think of it. Sure. Oh, fuck, sure, eh? Man, you know about my backside, I'll treat your ass on the full of it, came, eh? Sure. Oh, sure, you dumb fucking bastard. You realise that, eh? And you realise how drunk they get. They could wear a skirt and not care. And how they could invent a sport like golf. Here's my idea for a fucking sport. A knock a ball in a gopher hole. Oh, you mean like pool? Fuck off, pool! Not with a straight stick, with a little fucked up stick. A whack the ball that goes in a gopher hole. Oh, you mean like croquet? Fuck croquet! I put the hole hundreds of yards away! Oh, fuck out of here! It's great fun there! Oh, yeah, that's a great thing! Oh, like a bowling thing? Fuck no! Not straight, I put shit in the way! Like trees and bushes and high grass, so you can lose your fucking ball and go whacking away with a fucking tire iron! whacking away, and each time you miss, you feel like you're gonna have a stroke. Fuck, that's what we'll call it. A stroke, because every time you miss, you feel like you're gonna fucking die. Oh, great. Oh, and here's a bit of back. Oh, fuck, this is brilliant. Right near the end, I'll put a flat piece with a little flag to give you fucking hope. But then I'll put a pool and a sandbox to fuck with your ball again. Ah, you'll be there trashing your ass, jerking away in the sand. Only you do this one time. Fuck no! 18 fucking times! The manly sport of golf, where you can dress like a pimp and no one will care. Where you can wear clothes that even a blind gay man would go, oh, dear Christ. Those are loud. This is not carnival. What the fuck are you on? Even the alligator's going, asshole. There's another drug. Another drug they don't tell you is a drug. It's a class 4 narcotic, alcohol. And the only warning they have on a bottle of alcohol is don't drink this if you're pregnant. Bullshit, that's how you got pregnant, number one. And alcohol is especially dangerous for people like myself, alcoholics. Or you can say ethanol challenge, whatever you want to call it. And people are going to, Robin, how do I know if I'm an alcoholic? Well, as one, let me give you some warning signs. Number one, after a night of heavy drinking, you wake up fully clothed going, hey, somebody's shitting my pants. Number two, you have a couple of cocktails, you find yourself on the freeway going, what are these fuckers doing going the wrong way? Number two. Number three, you get drunk, you go out for Indian food, you wake up in Bombay with a camel licking your balls. Ta-da! You are an alcoholic. And some people say, Robin, I'm a functioning alcoholic, which is, you can be one. It's like being a paraplegic lap dancer. You can do it. Just not as well as the others, really. And they say alcoholism is peer pressure. Bullshit. Peer pressure for an alcoholic is, come here. And I believe alcoholics are God's rodeo clowns. We're the ones doing the stupid shit nobody else will do. We're the ones coming on a shoot number 5 on a fifth of vodka, like, Wee-ha! Looking for a woman who's going, ew, you're the one, yeah! And we're moody little motherfuckers, too, because we'll be like, God damn it, man, I love you. I'll fucking kill you. Step outside. I'll kick my ass. God damn it. Let's do this. Poor me. God damn. Poor me. Pour me another drink. And we think we're sexy, too, because we'll come up to women going like, hey, baby, were your parents retarded? Because you sure are special. And we see nothing wrong with that. We've got backup. If that doesn't work, we go, hey, sit on my face. I'll guess your weight. Yeah. And ladies, if you take an alcoholic home for the night, oh, good luck. You're in for a fun evening. It's like playing pool with a rope. Good fucking luck. He'll be like, I love you. I love you. And the next morning, that all-important question, who the fuck are you? Oh my God, well, at least I get a sweater. Cool, fucking. Because you see, as an alcoholic, you will violate your standards quicker than you can lower them. You will do shit that even the devil would go, dude. And there's a voice that tells alcoholics we can drink. It's the same voice you hear if you can go up to the top of a very large building and you look over the side. There's a little voice that goes, jump. You can fly. Even though your asshole is going, no, you can't. And if you ever thought about jumping off a tall building, there was a guy who jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge. He survived, and he said this. He said, halfway down, I thought it was a bad idea. And some things you may want to stay away from while drinking heavily, eBay, not a good idea. eBay and alcoholism, perfect storm of addiction. You'll find yourself up to your ass in George Foreman grills and ShamWows. Another thing you don't want to do while really drunk is get a tattoo. I did. I got really loaded. I got a tattoo in Mandarin that says happiness and laughter right here. I think it says that. I've never had a Chinese person that close to my balls going, that's what it says.
But I had a friend get really fucked up, and he got a tattoo in Mandarin that's supposed to say Golden Warrior, and a Chinese friend said, no, it says Ass Monkey. Then the idiot went out and got drunk again and got a tattoo in Hindu that was supposed to say Dawn of Enlightenment, and a Hindu friend said, no, it says Deliveries on Tuesday. So he is now the Ass Monkey who delivers on Tuesday for the rest of his life. And girls, if you want to get that lovely tattoo of the sunrise rising out of your ass crack, gorgeous when you're 20, but when you're 50, it's an octopus chasing a fucking starfish. So no. Be careful. And if they made a drug that allowed you to drink and not get drunk, an alcoholic would go, what happens if you take two? No. Because we have these things called blackouts as alcoholics. It's not really blackouts. It's more like sleepwalking with activities. Kind of strange. I believe it's your conscience going into a witness protection program. It's your conscience going, you're about to fuck a hobbit. I gotta go. Good luck. My crowd, we're here tonight. Again, once again, my home. Hi, the Marin County people where I grew up. Mom's here. Mama? Mama, Oedipus, Schmedipus, I love you. Boy, well, I guess we should get to the show real quick. People are going,
we paid good money now.
People in Marin paid more than good money. They paid beyond money. Yes. People going into Marin County say, my God, look at that little rainbow. Isn't that cute? Lie, they lied to you. It's an ethnic detector. We have two Negroes heading south.
Wow, what the hell, man?
Those people are so damn wealthy, they don't get the crabs, they get the lobsters. People with names like... I have friends with names like Biff, Tad, Muffy. How are you? Good to see you. They don't buy Lacoste shirts, they actually staple a live alligator to the house. Little medic alert badges that say, please, a Perrier and a BMW, quickly. A couple of months ago, they had a white shark off the coast of Marin. People were thinking, thank God, at least it was white. Yes, come. You never see that white shark, though, swimming in the bay, come up near Oakland, because people be going, get your ass out of the water. Come on. Get your ass out of the water. I'll make some shoes out of your booty, make it. Come on. Come on out, I'm waiting for you. Come on, Leonard, get. And I'll use your fins for my Cadillac, so fuck it, come on out. We sip some wine now for a moment here. Little eraser on the blackboard of life. There are white wines, there are red wines, but why are there no black wines like Reggie, a motherfucker? It goes with fish, meat, any damn thing it wants to. Thank you, Lumpy. Isn't it nice, though? Have someone like Mean Joe Green advertising it? You better buy this or nail your ass to a tree. But if you ever drink the elite wines, you know, the puy-fousse, as we say, downtown pussy-fussy. They always have the guys who taste the wines going, Ah, absurd yet flaccid. They're over here. But I love the very, very special wines, the wines like Thunderbird, Night Train, the type of wines where you take one sip and your body says, everybody out, two exits, no waiting. Some heavy-duty paint thinner in those wines. And always on those bottles of wine, it says, like, serve before Friday. In the bottom, it says, serve chilled. And I'm sure a lot of winos come into the store going, pardon me? But this sucker is tepid. Would you deposit this in a refrigeratory receptacle till it's 58 degrees Fahrenheit? I like my wine like I like my women, ready to pass out. Now, will you just put that in there? I'll be out front, whizzing on your doorway. You gotta be careful, though, if you're drinking a little too much. You get a little drunky-wunky. And you try and drive home, and the police nail your ass. If you're driving in the south, it's usually, stop, Rashid. If you're driving in California, it's usually, will you get out of the car, realize your true potential, will share some energy for a brief moment? If you're driving in San Francisco, the policeman usually gets out and goes, search me, I might have something on me. But you must be careful.
Especially if you've been smoking a little marijuana. Yes, yes. Yes, the police have a new test to nail you. What they do is they pull you over, they get out of the car, walk towards you like this. Will you get out of the car? Then you're trying to be cool. You're trying to maintain, going, get in the damn car. If you're doing a little cocaine, the police just go behind you, get in the car. But they have a test to see if you've been drinking a little. What they do normally is they pull you over to the side and say, do you realize you're weaving? To which you reply, weave? I don't even knit. At that point, a little baton goes right up Happy Land. So you have to be careful. They have a new drunk driving test. I want you to know this, just in case you get pulled over by le polizia. Yeah? Be careful. First of all, they make you go like this. They make you stop. Put your arms out. Close your eyes. Makes you feel like Easter. Watch out. Then they go like this. They make you touch your nose twice. They go like, start off one, two. And here's the new part. I want you to know this. The new part is simply like, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, and nine, and fussy, fussy, one, fussy, fussy, two, Uganda, 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 yes. At that point, you just have to look at the officer, you look him right in the eye, and say, fuck it, I'm drunk. Like we all know, though, if alcohol's a crutch, then Jack Daniels is the wheelchair. You roll right over that abyss going, ah-dee-dee-da-dee. Doesn't matter where you're from in the country, you take one sip of Jack Daniels, and you're in the road company in Deliverance going, squee! How about you just dropping them panties? Who cares? Let's go now. You have like 8 glasses of Jack Daniels, you forget the English language. You just have one massive vowel movement. Are you going now, Al? If you're lucky, you find someone else that drunk going, I don't care. You want to go out now? For sure. I don't know. But if you drink this shit, you'll have to pay the price in the morning. Because you get out of bed and all of a sudden you realize, oh shit, gravity works. There you are, there you are. And you have to worship at the old porcelain altar. Oh, damn, I didn't put the seat up again. And you better pray you have a friend that'll help you. Like, you okay?
I'm fine.
Just don't flush me, dear God. Don't flush me now. And then you make the mistake of going to work. What a fool, because you can hear snails crawl. All of your other friends who haven't drank that night come over. How you doing, Bob? Good to see you. Why don't you just eat shit and die? A little Jack last night? Well, why'd you... Oh, fuck off! Why couldn't he be right here? Wouldn't it be nice if Mr. Happy were in the middle of your chest? Should make dancing a lot more fun. You'd be dancing going like... Having a nice night, Betty?
Yes, I am, Tom, but what's that?
Fountain pen.
Well, it's leaking.
Oh. Like, and it's a strange relationship that men have with Mr. Happy. It usually starts... Oops, here comes my ride. What were we talking about? Doesn't matter. I think it's kind of once again we went off that way. The police set me off. It's like that way, I guess, for most people. But we men know the first time you met Mr. Happy was during a time called puberty. Puberty is when nature says, shake hands with Mr. Happy. You know that. You know what it's like. You know, you're upstairs, usually with a copy of National Geographic, playing Senor Wences.
Will you call me in the city?
Not to me. But no one had the real guts. No one had the honesty when you're locked in the bathroom. Your father's knocking on the door. You're in there oiling the old baseball glove. And your father's knocking on the door going, what are you doing in there, son? No one had the honesty to say, going blind! Oh, damn it, I don't care. If it feels this good, I'll take the hair. I don't mind. And then you had the other problems when you're going through puberty, something called erections.
They'd happen at the wrong time. You'd be having your first close dance all of a sudden. Gosh, Becky, nice. Wah!
Don't go away. Do you find me repulsive?
When actually you felt like a pirate going, ah, ha, ha, ha. Send the bitch back to me now. Don't be lying to me now, Jim Crack.
Ah, but you girls. You girls and Madam Wonderful. Yes, you got to go through puberty riding the mechanical pony in front of the supermarket. Remember that?
Mama, can I have another quarter?
Listen, if they're so hot, how come they're not tearing up the charts, babe?
Because you never play them, babe.
At CITR, our hosts choose the music they play. That means our charts actually reflect the tastes of music lovers, as opposed to focus groups. So if you want to know what's really tearing up the charts, get your hands on a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or go online to CITR.ca. CITR's charts are based on actual spins motivated by actual preference. No payola, no marketing, just good tunes. Refreshing, no?